Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today on our show, we'll have the latest developments in the corruption trial against Congressman Duncan Hunter. Meanwhile, in our nation's capital, the House has voted to condemn President Donald Trump's policy regarding Turkey, which critics say betrayed our Kurdish allies and led to the release of over 800 ISIS prisoners. Hear how your local congressional representatives voted on today's show. A new state bill will require later start times for many students in California, but rural schools are exempted. We'll have details later on today. In East County, the owners of the Carlton Oaks Golf Course have some big plans for the site in Santee. The city of La Mesa has filed a lawsuit against opioid manufacturers and distributors, and amid high fire danger, when many are facing power outages across our region, the county is asking everyone to please clear defensible space and do your part to protect against wildfires. Today on our bookshelf segment, host Raina Menasche will be interviewing Susan Neiman. She's the author of Learning from the Germans, who is recently in town for an author appearance. Hear what parallels she sees between how Germany is atoning for the Holocaust and what steps she believes the United States should take as reparations for the damage done by slavery and civil rights violations. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, where East County matters.
Congressman Duncan Hunter's wife, Margaret, has asked for a 4-month delay in sentencing after she pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy. Delaying her sentencing until April would give prosecutors more time to bolster their federal corruption case against Congressman Hunter, whose trial date has been delayed until January. Lawyers for Margaret Hunter and her estranged husband, the indicted Alpine Republican, jointly asked Judge Thomas Whelan to delay the date she learns her fate until after her husband's trial. Margaret Hunter could get up to 5 years in prison, but her cooperation with prosecutors, including testimony at Duncan Hunter's criminal trial, may yield a lighter penalty. The Hunters were both charged in August 2018 with using more than $250,000 in campaign funds for personal use, including an Italian vacation. But Margaret Hunter in June changed her plea to guilty. Duncan Hunter has pleaded not guilty to 60 counts of corruption. Duncan Hunter's trial is expected to take 4 weeks, ending just before the March 3rd primary election and potentially after some votes have already been cast by voters with mail-in ballots. If convicted, Hunter could be sentenced to serve out the next few years or more in federal prison, and could be ejected by House members if he were to win re-election from behind bars. Hunter faces 3 other Republicans, a Democratic candidate, and an independent in the 50th Congressional District race. The top 2 vote-getters in the March primary will advance to a November runoff election. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
Last week, the House passed a bipartisan resolution denouncing President Donald Trump's decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria in order to allow Turkey to attack Kurdish forces. 129 Republicans joined 225 Democrats to pass the resolution condemning Trump's action, which many veterans and military leaders have called a betrayal of the Kurds, our U.S. allies in the region who have helped America fight against ISIS. But Congressman Duncan Hunter backed President Trump and broke with his own party to vote against the resolution, which was supported by 2/3 of Republicans in the House as well as all Democrats. Hunter, the Marine combat veteran, fighting for his political life in the 50th Congressional District amid federal corruption charges, stood alone in the San Diego County delegation. Democrats Scott Peters, Mike Levine, Susan Davis, and Juan Vargas all backed the resolution. Hunter was one of only 2 California Republicans to oppose the resolution, joined by Tom McClintock of Central California's 4th District. Hunter spokesman Michael Harrison explained the vote by noting that the president ran on a promise of removing the United States from endless wars and engagements. American forces have defeated ISIS and should leave, he told Times of San Diego via email, adding that the Kurds are not a standing nation and that the U.S. does not have a formal agreement to stay in the region permanently. But 8 years ago, Hunter was for a long U.S. Mideast troop presence, in Afghanistan at least. I think we need to have military there for the next 30 or 40 years, he told Patch editors, although at a much smaller level, mostly intelligence and special forces. The abrupt U.S. withdrawal from the region has led to mass panic, slaughter of Kurds by Turkey, and fears of genocide. Kurds have fled the region, including Kurdish soldiers who were guarding ISIS. Over 800 fighters and supporters have reportedly escaped a prison and are now free. Hunter is a co-sponsor of a new bill by Wyoming's Liz Cheney that now calls for sanctions on Turkey in response to Ankara's military offensive against Kurdish forces, but that can't undo the damage already done. San Diego Congressman Scott Peters called the 354-60 vote against Trump's action a rebuke of the president's misguided decision to abandon our Kurdish allies and allow a deadly Turkish incursion into Syria. Tragically, the damage is done, he said. Our withdrawal subjects Syria to mass regional destabilization and the Kurds to potential war crimes. It also created a vacuum that makes Americans less safe as ISIS resurges and Turkey, Russia, and Iran attempt to assert their presence in the area. Congresswoman Susan Davis said via Twitter that she voted to condemn what she called President Trump's disastrous decision that had added to an already dangerous situation in the Middle East. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
This is Gerald Stevenson with an education report. Middle and high school students in urban and suburban areas will soon get to sleep in later due to Senate Bill 328, which was signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom. The bill requires that middle schools start no earlier than 8 a.m. and high school at 8:30 a.m. or later. But rural districts are exempted. The rural exception is due primarily to long distances that some rural students must travel, as well as accommodations for farm workers in agricultural areas. A definition of rural districts is expected to be hammered out in an upcoming legislative session, since the bill won't take effect until 2022. The measure applies to all other public middle and high schools in the state, including charters, but not to private schools. It does not apply to before-school extracurricular activities. California is the first state in the nation to mandate later start times for schools. The bill, however, proved controversial, with support from doctors groups, parents, and teachers, but opposition from a major teachers union and the California School Boards Association. The law allows 3 years for schools and school districts to plan and implement these changes. Governor Newsom says, "The science shows that teenage students who start their day later increase their academic performance, attendance, and overall health." The bill was authored by State Senator Anthony Portantino, who says it puts children's health and welfare ahead of bureaucracy. It had support of some local lawmakers, including Assemblymembers Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher and Todd Gloria. The bill was also backed by the American Academy of Pediatricians, the California Medical Association, and the California State Parent Teachers Association, or PTA. The Pediatricians Professional Group has recommended that adolescents should not start school before 8:30 a.m. in most districts and recognizes insufficient sleep in adolescents as a public health issue. Teens and adolescents are more apt than younger children to stay up late doing homework, socializing with friends, or working at paid jobs, leading to insufficient sleep and fatigue. The bill has drawn opposition, however, from some school districts and parents who say later start times burden parents to change work schedules or find alternative transportation to get kids to school. After-school activities could be pushed later in the day, and bus schedule changes could cost cash-strapped districts more money. A similar measure was vetoed in 2018 by then-Governor Jerry Brown, and another such bill was rejected by the legislature in 2017. California Teachers Association spokeswoman Claudia Briggs says the new law could have a disproportionately negative effect on working families, particularly laborers and service industry employees who don't have the option of starting their workday later. She adds, "We know from experience that many of these parents will drop their children off at school at the same time they do now, regardless of whether there is a supervision, and there is not enough funding from the state for before-school programs to ensure the safety of students who will be dropped off early." After the San Diego Unified School District voluntarily moved to a later start time, a 10 News investigation found some parents with early work schedules dropping off children as early as 7 a.m. outside locked school gates without adult supervision. Those opposed to the new law argued that decisions on when to start classes should be made at the local level to best meet individual community needs.
The owners of Carlton Oaks Golf Course have submitted plans to the city of Santee to create an upscale resort on the 62-acre site. The plan calls for keeping and upgrading the golf course, as well as building 285 residential units, including a 5-story condo complex, additional residential units, a hotel, and an assisted living center to replace a motel, bar, and grill currently on the property. The hotel will include a clubhouse, pool, spa, and outdoor meeting space. Several Santee residents who live next to the golf course spoke at the October 9th Santee City Council meeting, raising concerns over the project's density, blocking of view corridors, and traffic concerns. Santee senior planner Doug Thompson confirmed that part of the project will encroach on the floodplain of the San Diego River, which means the project will require a general plan amendment. Thompson said it's the city's policy to discourage development in areas that usually sustain some flooding during the winter. The plans also trigger the involvement of federal and state agencies, including the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Federal Emergency Management Administration, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and California Water Quality Resource Board. The property owner, Alika LLC, and its principal, John Chen, did not respond to interview requests. Mike Aiken, a director for the Carlton Oaks Golf Course, said the plans reflect the owner's intention to build a nice destination resort facility with all the amenities, and something that the city will be proud of. He said the owners plan to hold a series of public workshops in the near future to give residents information about the project. Councilman Stephen Houlihan, who represents District 4, where the golf course is located, said he's talked with neighbors and the owner's representatives and hopes the two groups can arrive at a compromise solution. Councilman Houlihan voiced concerns over building new units on a floodplain. He recalled a 100-year storm that hit the city in 1977 and washed out much of the ball fields at Mast Park, and a similar storm could have a devastating impact on new development. But Houlihan said he supports the project's construction of senior housing units, adding that more senior housing is needed in Santee. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
The city of La Mesa has joined other jurisdictions in California and nationwide, directing the city attorney to file a lawsuit in state superior court against numerous opioid manufacturers and distributors. Mayor Mark Arapostathis says the lawsuit is necessary to end opioid addiction in our community and its adverse impacts, adding, "We can no longer stand by and witness our citizens suffering the consequences of the reprehensible actions of these businesses and individuals." The city of La Mesa has a death rate from prescription opioids that is more than 4 times higher than from heroin. La Mesa is suing multiple companies and parties in the opioid industry, including the Sacklers family, Teva Pharmaceutical Industries USA, Inc., Janssen Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Endo Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Allegrin Finance, LLC, and N. Mallinckrodt, LLC. Opioid distributors were also named in the suit, including Cardinal Health, Inc., Amerisource Bergman Corporation, and McKesson Corporation. The lawsuit alleges that manufacturers and distributors of opioids engaged in conduct that directly caused doctors to prescribe overwhelming amounts of opioids, and that the companies intentionally neglected their obligations to prevent irresponsible distribution of highly addictive substances. The suit alleges public nuisance, fraud, negligence, unjust enrichment, civil conspiracy, false advertising, negligent failure to warn consumers, and fraudulent transfer. The term opioid includes all drugs derived from the opium poppy. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration describes opioids as powerful pain-reducing medications that includes a prescription oxycodone, hydrocodone, and morphine, among others, and have both benefits as well as potentially serious risks. While these medications can help manage pain, when misused or abused, opioids can cause serious harm, including addiction, overdose, and death. La Mesa's lawsuit seeks to recover costs and tax resources taken from the city and its citizens due to the actions of opioid manufacturers and distributors. The city seeks reparations for economic damages as well as damages the health and welfare of its citizens due to the ongoing opioid crisis. Reporting for East County Magazine in La Mesa, this is Gene Carpenter.
By law, San Diego County residents are required to have at least 100 feet of defensible space around their homes. To help meet this requirement and improve the likelihood that your home will survive a wildland fire, the Fire Safe Council of San Diego is offering help for homeowners with funds from a U.S. Forest Service grant. To participate in the no-cost chipping program, homeowners must first clear their property of overgrown and hazardous dried brush. Once the piles of cleared vegetation are ready, the homeowner can register online for the program. The Fire Safe Council will then schedule a trained, licensed, and insured crew to visit the property and chip vegetation on site. Chipped materials will be left on the property and can be used as mulch to suppress weeds. In addition, a defensible space assistance program helps residents who are physically and financially unable to maintain the state-mandated 100 feet of defensible space. Low-income seniors and disabled residents can get help with brush and tree trimming, raking dead leaves and vegetation, and chipping of removed vegetation. To learn more about both of these programs and to register, San Diego residents can visit the Fire Safe Council of San Diego County website at firesafesdcounty.org and click on the program's options. Reporting on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Susan Neiman, author of the new book, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. Susan Neiman is also the author of five other books, including Evil in Modern Thought, Moral Clarity, A Guide for Grown-Up Idealists, Why Grow Up, great title, Subversive Thoughts for an Infantile Age, The Unity of Reason, Rereading Kant, and Slow Fire. Welcome, Susan. It's great having you on Bookshelf.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with your fascinating background. You have been called an American moral philosopher, cultural commentator, and essayist. How does your personal, your life, your history lead you to your books, and especially to this topic of evil?
You know, one of the nicer things about getting older is that your life starts to have a shape that you didn't realize when you were younger.
Good point.
And I now realize that probably the most important motivating factor in my life was the fact that I was born in the South, in Atlanta, Georgia, and my mother was involved in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. We weren't real Southerners. My parents were Yankee Jews who had moved down to Atlanta just before I was born, and it was always clear to me that we weren't from there. And all I wanted to do when I was a kid growing up was to get out of the South and go to New York or Europe,
right?
About which I knew nothing. But looking back on it, growing up in a time when there was clear good, there was clear evil, and my mother, who was not an intellectual or a politician, she was a thoughtful housewife, was there as part of a group of people who were making real change, real progress for the better. I think that influenced me probably more than anything else, led me to study philosophy later after some interesting circuitous routes. And in 1982, I was writing a dissertation on Immanuel Kant, and it was easy to get a fellowship to spend a year in Berlin, which is what I thought it would be. It was a time at which very few Americans and even fewer Jews set foot in Germany. So I was being asked all the time, what's a nice Jewish girl going spend a year in the home of the enemy? And my answer at the time was, look, the war has been over for almost 40 years. Isn't it racist to blame the entire German people? At this point in time, I'm going to go and I'm going to think about Kant and Goethe and forget about the war. And I land in Berlin, and the war is very, very present.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. So that pivoted me into a direction of thinking about evil, thinking about, in particular, how nations come to terms with the evil in their past.
How was it present, the war, when you first went there?
So, first of all, it was physically present. You could still see bullet holes. There was the wall, of course, which is a result of the war. But most importantly, they were not the big monuments at the time, but young or youngish people in their 20s and 30s who were ashamed and horrified about the fact that their parents and teachers had been Nazis were pressing to do something. So that went on through art, film, theater. The longest running play in Berlin at the time was a little off, like an off-Broadway production called It Wasn't Me, Hitler Did It.
Wow.
And
what a great title.
Right. Which was in the West the general view of the people who were in power. And these people, civil society, usually fairly educated at that point, people who were pushing for examining Berlin's history, people would do explorations of their neighborhoods. So who were the Nazis? Was there anybody hiding Jews? What actually went on? And doing little exhibits. At that point, almost nothing was state-funded because the West German government wasn't interested in examining its past. The East German government was rather different because the leaders of the East German government had all spent the war in concentration camps or in exile in Moscow because the Nazis' first victims were not Jews. They were Germans who were communists and social democrats, political prisoners. So that was who was running the east side of the country. Now, the anti-fascism was certainly instrumentalized at various points by the East German government, but at least the basic message, Nazis were bad and defeating them was good, was something that you heard on the east side of the country. You didn't at the time hear it on the west side of the country.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
So listen to you talk, I get this sense that you've always been the other in a way. And yet that's been okay with you. It sounds like it's part of your identity now.
That's such a good question. The truth is, I once realized, and I was actually in California at a conference at Stanford, and I once realized, well, if I got to have two lives, it really would be quite nice to feel at home in the world and go to the weddings of the people your children went to kindergarten with. But if you only get to have one, I'm happy with the one that I've had. Yes, I have lived and worked in three countries. I think growing up as a liberal Yankee Jew in Atlanta of the late 50s and 60s probably predestined me to not feel at home in the world.
Right, it carved your shape.
Yeah.
So your new book, Learning from the Germans, it's described as a combination of philosophy, reflection, stories, and interviews with Americans and Germans who grapple with their history. Is there a story or interview or conversation reflection that stands out in your mind now?
There are so many, but I will take one. Let me say that in talking about my background, there's a way in which I've been writing this book all my life, But it's also true that this book became, the idea for the book happened at a particular moment. It was June 9th, 2015, and I was standing in my apartment in Berlin watching President Obama give the eulogy for the 9 churchgoers who were massacred in Charleston, and I was crying. I was standing up at a standing desk and watching this. And at the same time, there was something hopeful about it because Nikki Haley, of all people, was taking down the Confederate flag and Walmart was saying, you know, they weren't going to sell Confederate memorabilia anymore. And I thought, gosh, America is finally ready to face up to its violent, murderous past. And I've been watching Germany do this for 30 years right. and more. The Germans have long compound words for everything, so they actually have a word for this. Actually, they have several words. Vergangenheitsaufarbeitung, which I translate as working off the past. So America is finally doing this. And at the same time, just a couple of months later, thousands of Germans welcomed 1 million refugees. And really welcomed them, not just, I mean, they stood on the train stations with signs saying welcome. They took people into their homes. They spent time and are still spending time teaching them German, helping them with the bureaucracy.
Now that's a nice story.
Playing soccer and music with the kids. And it is still the case that although we've had some backlash and we have a right-wing party that's now in parliament, unfortunately, an anti-immigrant party, it is still the case that more people are involved in active refugee integration than voted for the right-wing party. So I thought, gosh, this is, you can tell when people actually face up to their past, it affects the way they deal with political questions in the present. Mm-hmm. And I decided to write this book. And I, at the same time, I got a letter. I had written a small thing that got onto the internet from someone who described himself as a white conservative in Mississippi who was genuinely curious about what the South should do with its past, whether the streets should be renamed, mm-hmm. whether the statues should come down. This is 2015. And I got invited to to give a talk in Oxford, Mississippi, at the University of Mississippi. I, who was nervous about crossing the Mississippi state line, was absolutely taken with the work of a small group called the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation. And I was so impressed by the work that they were doing, half black, half white, examining Southern history, that I asked them if I could come back for half a year and just watch and follow what they were doing and interviewing people. So there, I did a lot of really interesting interviews, both in the American South. I should say, I don't believe that racism is only a problem in the South. On the contrary. But I focus on the South in the book because the South is like a magnifying glass for the rest of the country. And because there's so many African Americans there, the question of race is always present. You can't avoid it in the way that you can in other parts of the country. White people can avoid it the way that you can in other parts of the country. And also because Mississippians, Southerners in particular, but especially Mississippians, are obsessed with their history. So you can't say, oh, it's the American spirit, forget about your past, and right. look towards the future. They're always talking about their history. They may get it wrong, and they build a lot of myths, but the history is there. So I spent half a year there, and probably the most impressive person I had the privilege of interviewing was Bryan Stevenson, who is one of my heroes. Bryan Stevenson is well known for two things. One is he wrote an incredible book called Just Mercy, which talks about mass incarceration and the death penalty. He spends a good part of his life fighting to keep people on death row from being executed. And it's a beautiful book. I highly recommend it. But the other thing that he's known for in this country is creating the National Lynching Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. And I read his book, and I read some interviews with him in which he said he was inspired by visiting Germany, that the National Lynching Museum was inspired by visiting Germany, seeing the way that the iconography of many places in Germany, particularly Berlin, has been transformed by monuments. Many people have seen a picture of the Holocaust Memorial, but there are 473 monuments to the victims of Nazism.
I had no idea. 473?
Just in Berlin.
You're kidding.
Just in Berlin. No. You know, Germans being thorough, there are books about,
right,
you know, that have tallied them. So Brian Stevenson was somebody I very much wanted to interview. He's an African-American who said the Germans have genuinely felt shame, and we need to feel shame in this country. We need to transform our iconography to remember the victims. We also need to remember the heroes. It was quite an interesting moment when he said, there were white Southerners who were opposed to slavery and lynching, and you don't know their names.
Right.
We need to remember their names so that we can have the fabric of our country can be expanded and rewritten in certain ways to include also our shameful past, also the people who resisted, and have that affect our contemporary politics the way the Germans have had that. He was very impressed that people said to him, death penalty? We can't have a death penalty here. That's what the Nazis did.
I'm hearing a couple of different central points. And one is that no matter how dark something is, an event, there is always someone who's trying to do good within that. And the other one is that if we don't deal with our past, it comes back or it just doesn't go away. And so I'm wondering about now here in the United States, do you think that some of the things that are happening here are because perhaps we haven't fully dealt with the past?
I think there is no question that the current occupant of the White House was elected in part because millions of Americans were threatened by the fact that not only had there been a black family in the White House for 8 years, it's that every member of that family, including the first granny, Marian Robinson, behaved with more grace and dignity and integrity than we have seen, certainly in my lifetime. And in a way, the Obama family, I disagree with some of his policies, but that doesn't matter. In a way, they undercut basically every excuse for racism. One of my daughters said, she was just, I think, about 20 at the time. She said, I can't imagine anything worse than being a teenager in the White House, but being the first African-American teenagers in the White House. And they did it perfectly.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that enraged, I mean, I know because it was said, it enraged millions of Americans who feel threatened by the fact that the demography is changing and that the Obamas deprived us of any genuine excuses for racism. The silver lining that I am discovering is that for the rest of us, who supported President Obama and are horrified by the racism that we're seeing now in this administration, I think white people have become aware that white supremacy has a deeper and longer history than we were able to acknowledge. If you think about it, white supremacy wasn't even a word that got used in the mainstream media until about a year and a half ago.
That's a good point.
You know? And, I mean, that was a radical left term, and now you see it in the New York Times and the Washington Post and so on. You know, we always knew, yes, there was slavery, but then we fought a civil war. Yes, there was segregation, but then we had the civil rights movement. And I think the backlash to the Obamas that produced the Trump family has made us aware of, no, we actually need to examine how deep these problems go. And you see it in the discussions over the Confederate memorials. People are much more aware of what happened during Reconstruction, of when the memorials were created and why. You just see a level of discussion that shows that white Americans are coming, or many of us,
especially I think the younger people,
absolutely, are closer to where Black Americans have been for a long time.
So if you were to recommend a way for us to deal with our past, I understand that, you know, you talk about reparations towards Blacks in the United States. Do you think that that would also affect how immigrants are treated? Do you think that that would reverberate through other groups?
So the reparations question is a complicated one. I don't know how much time you want to spend on that. I was not sure what I felt about reparations. I've seen various sides of the debate, and African Americans who were against reparations because they feel that the real issue is social democracy and that America should be a social democracy. Well, I have the good fortune to live in a social democracy, even under a conservative government. Bernie Sanders, you know, proposals are to the right of Angela Merkel's.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because certain things like healthcare and education and a month-long paid vacation and over a year parental leave and all of those kinds of things are taken to be rights and not benefits. And that's pretty much true all over Europe. So I would be in favor of all of those things for the United States, of course. But I began thought experiment to think, well, Holocaust survivors who stayed in Germany after the war, and some did, would get the same level of social rights as everybody else did. Wouldn't we think they were owed something more? Now, I know the question is always, yes, but slavery was generations ago. The truth is, if you dig into the history, we had forms of neo-slavery that lasted all the way up to the Second World War, and we have had victims of racist government policies up through officially the late 60s, unofficially much longer, mm-hmm. of course. So I think African Americans are a different case from the immigrants because, of course, they were captured and enslaved and brought to this country against their wills, although most of them have wanted to stay and become genuine Americans. They have fought to become considered full-fledged citizens of America. Immigration is a different story, but what I think we certainly need to do is, and I think the more we face racism, of course, the better off every minority group will be in this country, although it's going to be the case that white people will soon be in the minority. But to recognize the contributions of immigrants, the way this is an immigrant country, there's an absolutely marvelous Bruce Springsteen song, which I love, American Land, the hands who built the country, we're still trying to keep out, you know.
Right.
And when somebody in the Trump administration wanted to rewrite Emma Lazarus's poem on the Statue of Liberty, give me, you're tired, you're poor, you're hungry, you're poor huddled masses yearning to breathe free. That's America. That's the idea of America.
It's the ideal.
It is the ideal of America. And to keep lifting that up and keep remembering that we would not be, I mean, we're very far from realizing all the ideals that we proclaim, but we wouldn't be even close without immigrants. By the way, this was an interesting statistic that I found out. Most white people in this country are descended from people who immigrated after the Civil War, in the beginning of the 20th century.
That's
numbers
interesting.
Are. Isn't that? Yeah, I was surprised by that, to find that out too. But
we're such a divided country, though, now. It feels that way, at least. As a citizen, it feels like we are, I think, the most divided we've been in a long time. So how do you see us moving towards some of these lessons that you say Germany has learned?
I think we already are. I think the very fact that we're seeing things like, I mean, when I wrote the chapter on reparations, I knew if I was talking about you know, parallels between the German experience and the American experience. And of course, they're different. I spend the first chapter of the book pointing out the differences. It's not that I think we can one-to-one apply the lessons that Germany had to this country. But I knew I was going to have to write about reparations. And when I finished thinking through that chapter, you know, you're a writer, you often write to figure out exactly what you
think. To figure out what you're writing.
Yeah, well, just to figure out, okay, do I believe this or that? I thought, oh boy, am I going out on a limb. And people who have agreed with me so far are going to get to the end of the book and say, no, now she's gone too far. I did not imagine that you would have presidential candidates 6 months later talking about this question or hearings in the House. So I think we're moving things like the 1619 project that the New York Times did, which is not just to commemorate the 400th anniversary of slavery, but to say, wait a second, we actually need to look at slavery and its consequences as fundamental to American history. It's not just a little blip.
Right.
It's, you know, it has affected our entire history. And if you've studied the history of post-war Germany, you realize, of course, Newt Gingrich is going to push back and say, no, you're tearing the fabric of our nation and we need to be proud of our country and so on. This is what the Nazis said for a good 50 years after the war. That is, even the former Nazis would talk about, oh, you know, the Wehrmacht, okay, there were atrocities, but they were committed by a few bad apples. The Wehrmacht was just defending their homeland, and our grandparents were heroes. I have pictures that show that. You know, people do not want to face shameful parts of their history. Of course they don't. Of course we'd rather look at the parts of our history that we're proud of.
I think a lot of people feel like it wasn't me. I didn't do it.
This is correct. But once you start reading about the ways in which America's wealth has been built on slavery, and that's not simply from cotton industry, although cotton was the oil of the 19th century. And there's a wonderful book called The Half Has Never Been Told. Highly recommend it. Because it shows how, in very surprising ways, how much of the American economy was built on that. But up to things like, in order to get the New Deal through Congress with Southern racist senators and representatives, FDR had to exclude domestic workers and farm workers from getting Social Security or housing loans. What percentage of African-American jobs were in farms or Social Security? Something like 70%. So what that meant is that it was that as white Americans were moving into the middle class and able to own their own homes and retire with some slight measure of Social Security, black Americans did not have the tools to get into the middle class. And that was not a question of individual prejudice. That was a question of law.
Yeah. Institutional prejudice.
Well, institutional law.
Right.
And, you know, when you realize if you're fortunate enough to inherit anything when your parents pass, you got to pay off their debts before you get to enjoy the inheritance. And there's justice in that. You can't simply say, oh, yeah, I'll take the house, but I don't want to pay off
I don't want the bills.
Life doesn't work that way. My view is that a grown-up relationship to our country is like a grown-up relationship to our parents. You know, when we're children, we basically accept everything they have to say. And when we're adolescents, maybe we reject everything they have to say. And when we're adults, we kind of sift through it and say, okay, I'm glad and proud that my mother gave me this set of values or this kind of way of looking at the world. And, you know, this is the stuff I'd rather not pass on to my children.
We find our identity.
Exactly. And but we find it also by dealing with the parts of our identity that we inherited and couldn't do anything about. So I think we need to do exactly the same thing with our country.
In the book, you say that the criminalization of African Americans was deliberate and intentional. So apart from this example of FDR and financial, you know, security, Social Security, can you give us another?
I can indeed. And this is another book recommendation. It's called Slavery by Another Name, won a Pulitzer. Highly recommended. A shocking book. So the 13th Amendment says you cannot take away another person's freedom unless they've committed a crime.
Correct.
So what do they do after Reconstruction in the South? They instituted so-called black codes, a set of laws for African Americans in which they virtually criminalized behavior from not being employed by a white person to talking loudly in the presence of a white woman to selling vegetables after sundown. I mean, criminalized almost everything. They then had excuses to lock up a vast number of African Americans and to rent them at extremely low wages to mining companies, plantations, certain factories making bricks. And often the people profiting from that labor were the same people in the sheriff's office or their brother-in-law or something. This was in many ways worse than chattel slavery, because a slave owner who pays $1,000 for a human being has at least an instrumental interest in protecting his investment and making sure that there's sort of minimum standards of nutrition and health that
are
met.
It's also more obvious. It's not as
correct.
Invisible.
Correct. But knowing that they had an unlimited supply of slave labor, many of these companies worked people to death. The mortality rate in some of them was 40%. And this went on again all the way, some instance of it, into the Second World War. It was called convict leasing. And it's quite horrible to know the reason why FDR got onto the case of the last cases of convict leasing. It's because somebody pointed out that the Japanese, they were in the middle of war, and the Japanese were pointing out that Americans didn't treat people of color all that well, so maybe the people of color shouldn't support America during the war. And FDR called the FBI and said, get on it, no more convict leasing.
Oh, okay.
So there's my favorite or least favorite example.
Yeah, least favorite.
Yeah.
Okay, right now, you still live in Berlin.
I do.
And you're still a Jewish woman.
I am.
So, and you're still from the South originally.
I am.
So what is that like for you now with all this knowledge and history in your head and what you work on and what you live? What is it like?
So it's interesting. In 1988, I had lived in Berlin for 6 years, and I decided to leave for two reasons. One was a terrible historical sense of smell or prescience or whatever. Everybody was saying, nothing is ever going to happen here again. This is a dead town. In 1988, nobody saw reunification or any of this coming. But the second is I had a three-year-old son, and it seemed very clear to me that I couldn't raise children to be normal. I couldn't raise Jewish children. I couldn't even raise non-Aryan children to be normal. A lot of my friends were originally Chilean or Greek or something, and it was a very different place than it was when I was offered a job 12 years later in 2000 as the director of the Einstein Forum, which is a public, interdisciplinary, international think tank. And I was not clear. I had acquired two more children, my twin daughters. I was not certain what it would be like for them to move there, and I made several trips and decided the New Berlin is really, it's really much more international. It's much more comfortable. Story I tell in the book is that a couple of years ago, I was planning a Seder, and I went to buy matzah meal. It used to be the case that there was one store in all Berlin and it was kind of hidden. That was when I lived in the 80s. Now I know that there are several. So I go to the store a couple of days before Pesach and the store owner says there's no matzah meal in all Berlin. We underestimated. The demand is over the top. There's 30,000 Israelis living here. And as I was thinking, am I going to grind it piece by piece to make the matzah balls? I realized that an Israeli friend of mine's parents were coming from Jerusalem to celebrate Passover with their son and daughter-in-law and grandson. And I could ask them if they'd bring an extra box. Bring one from Israel. So I feel quite comfortable. There is anti-Semitism. There is racism. I don't want to say that it's disappeared. It gets into the international press far more often than the pushback gets into the international press. I always meet people who've heard about one story or another. There was an Israeli Arab who was videotaped wearing a kippah and being attacked in Berlin maybe 3/4 of a year ago. And I immediately got an email from an old friend in L.A. saying, are you and your children safe? And I said, I hate to say it, but where were Jews killed this year? What country was that?
Right.
And what didn't get play was that after this incident happened, 2,500 Berliners, including our foreign minister, showed up for a demonstration the next day wearing kippot.
Wow.
And the tabloid, the city tabloid, which is in no sense, it's sort of center-right magazine, the daily, I don't know what the California equivalent would be. Its headline that day was, Berlin wears a kippah, and they had little paper kippot that you could cut out of the newspaper. I don't know if anybody wore them, but that is the pushback that people get and don't hear about very often here. So Berlin right now is a very multicultural city. My son and I, when the refugees had just arrived, he's an artist. He had an artist's residency in Marseille where he said he didn't feel like going swimming because the Mediterranean had become a graveyard. So when he came home for a visit and I said, well, let's do something fun. You want to go to an exhibit or something? He's an artist. He said, can we do something for the refugees? So I said, sure, of course. So we went and bought as much food as we could carry. We had trouble giving it away. There were so many people who were volunteering to do something for the refugees. We had to go around to different places. They said, we don't actually need any more. Try this place. So that's the kind of place that I live in now.
And now that you're on a book tour and you're going to all these different cities, does it feel different? I mean, does it feel like this is also, does it depend on the part of the country you're in? Does it depend on whether it's the city or the country in terms of how much we have evolved or devolved?
So I am on the first half of my book tour, which has taken me to places like New York, D.C., L.A., San Francisco. I'm about to head for the Deep South.
Okay.
And that will be interesting. Again, I am pleased and a little surprised at the openness and the interest in the claims that I have been making, which I think are part of this Americans facing how racist parts of this country are under the surface. But on the other hand, I met in Baltimore, a close friend of my brother's had just gotten back from Tijuana. There are organizations, in particular Jewish organizations, but also other religious groups who are volunteering to go down to the border to help give legal advice and take care of people applying for asylum. And she was very shaken by it. She was in tears about some of the horrible stories that she had heard. And I mentioned this in one talk that I was giving, and 3 or 4 people in L.A. said, oh, yeah, we've been down to the border, and my synagogue is doing this. And
so look at the heroes.
Yeah, exactly. A friend of mine wearing a button from Hias, my people were refugees too. Mm. So I do think that there are important things happening on the ground all over the country. Even in the Deep South, I know this because I'm in touch with the social justice activists that I know there.
I have one last question for you. What are you working on next?
A novel.
A novel, dear to my heart.
A novel that is mostly set in Berlin, so will cover some of the same basic issues, but from a quite different perspective, because, of course, a novel allows you more nuance,
yes,
different voices, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
Oh, well, we look forward to seeing it. Our time is up, Susan, but thank you so much for joining us. For more information on Susan Neiman and her books, please visit her website at http://Susan-Neiman, that's neiman.de/. It's different than what we usually read.
It's a German website.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. As temperatures climb, it's important to stay cool. Seniors and those without air conditioning are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness. The county has provided a list of cool zones where you can beat the heat, including places in East County, such as libraries and senior centers. All are free and open to the public during designated hours. You can find a list of school zones in your area at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine Show here on KNSJ. I want to take a moment to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to hear our show, where we report news that matters to people across our region. In an era of cuts to many major media outlets, shrinking local news coverage, and cries of fake news attacking journalists with courage to report the truth, it's important to recognize and support KNSJ Radio. KNSJ gives airtime for original reporting on issues that matter here in San Diego and East County, as well as national news that impacts people here at home. You can donate to help support real news, honest reporting, and inclusion of your community's views and voices at knsj.org. That website again is knsj.org. www.eastcountymagazine.org.